From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Good Weekend Talks, and I'm Conrad Marshall. Join us as we take a deep dive into the definitive stories of the day, brought to life here and in the pages of Good Weekend magazine. In this episode, we look back at a story about the Spanish flu by freelance writer and former Good Weekend editor, Fenella Suter. In what now seems an incredibly prescient piece, Fenella asks what we learned and failed to learn from the deadliest event in human history. Today, Fenella will be joined by Katrina Strickland, the editor of Good Weekend, and expert virologist Professor Kanta Subbarao for a discussion about mass infections, past and present. But first, actor Sarah Bishop will read the story in full. So sit down, stay safe, and have a listen to Are We Ready for Another Pandemic?
A chance encounter lets it loose in New South Wales. Then again, it thrives on chance encounters. On January 20th, 1919, two strangers find themselves in a railway carriage, sharing the long, rackety train journey from Melbourne to Sydney. It's midsummer, so perhaps they have a window open, perhaps not. Either way, they can't help but be near each other, breathing the same air, touching the same objects. One is an Australian soldier who has served in the Great War that ended the previous November. The other is a civilian, his identity never discovered, his fate unknown. We do know he was ill because the soldier, documented in medical records only as S.L., will later report that his travelling companion was suffering from aches and pains and a fever. Soon the virus that has busily been reproducing itself in the first man jumps across to the second. 2 days after the journey, S.L. comes down with the same symptoms. On January 23rd, and now very ill, he is admitted to Randwick Military Hospital in Sydney's east, apparently suffering from the disease, whose arrival everyone has been dreading. It has all the hallmarks of the terrifying pandemic influenza virus that scythed its way through the world's population the previous year. 48 hours later, the doctor who examined SL, the nurse who first attended him, and the orderly who lifted him into bed are all struck down by the illness. Admissions, mostly of people who have arrived from Melbourne, begin to grow. Later, it will emerge there were already 50 to 100 cases floating about in Melbourne earlier that month, undeclared as the pandemic infection. With frightening speed, the trickle turns into a wave. It's a bitter pill for the authorities, who had dared hope they could keep the country free of the pandemic by being prepared. In the preceding months, Australia has been the only country in the world to have tried, and managed for a time, to stave it off by strictly enforcing maritime and land quarantine. They'd seen what had happened across the way in New Zealand, where it killed close to 9,000 people in 2 months. But the virus is wily. Now it has escaped into New South Wales. In a moment, by land, on a train, in a sneeze, a cough, on a table, a cup, a playing card. By the second week of April, around 150 victims are being admitted into Sydney's hospitals every day. In Victoria, fatally slow to impose quarantine or declare infection, 685 people will die over about 8 weeks early in the year, killed by the virus itself or its secondary complications, often a particularly violent case of bacterial pneumonia. By June, Western Australia is reporting a sizeable outbreak. Indigenous populations are hopelessly vulnerable, with a mortality rate approaching 50% in some areas. Many of the pandemic's victims will survive, but death becomes commonplace. Entire households go down. In southern New South Wales, in one Kuma family, the story recorded by her sister, a mother of five will pull through, but wake from her fever to find the flu has taken her husband, her youngest baby, and the child she was carrying. Health authorities have scrambled to contain it, closing gathering places from pubs and dance halls to schools and churches, quarantining infected households, setting up inoculation and isolation depots, and making it compulsory to wear a mask in public. But by April, when a second wave hits, the game is up. The best that can be hoped for is to slow the spread and thus not swamp the hospitals. By the time the disease has run its course, it will have infected 40% of Australia's population, which stood at about 5 million. To put that into perspective, 2017's seasonal flu in Australia, the most widespread in a decade, infected less than 1% of the population. It caused an estimated 1,127 deaths, but that was in a population of 24 million. In 1919, the pandemic flu infected millions of Australians and killed at least 12,000, possibly 15,000. And then it was over, reduced to a trickle of deaths by December that year. There were just the reports to be written, the mourning to be managed, and life, post-war, post-pandemic, to be embraced by those still standing. It wasn't quite a lucky escape. Still, it wasn't anywhere near as terrible as it could have been. Despite those figures, Australia emerged comparatively unscathed from what would come to be called, without exaggeration, the deadliest plague in history and the single most deadly event ever recorded. Elsewhere, the calamitous pandemic, widely known as Spanish flu, had got underway in the first half of 1918. It peaked in frightful numbers in October that year, just as the world was looking forward to an end to World War I. It's hard to comprehend the devastation this tiny virus caused, and harder still to believe we've almost forgotten about it just a century later. We remember World War I, yet the war, for all its savage arsenals and endless waves of fine young men sent out as cannon fodder, was a far less efficient killing machine. The 1918 flu is thought to have infected up to 500 million people, about one-third of the world's population then. It's likely to have killed a staggering 50 million people, and possibly as many as 100 million. That's many more lives than the war stole. The war took 4 years to clock up its toll. The influenza pandemic managed the bulk of its work in less than a year. Given the very real possibility of future pandemics, and we had one as recently as 2009, the swine flu, the 1918 experience is a chilling reminder of a pandemic's speed and reach and the chaos it brings. According to John M. Barry, contemporary medical historian and author of The Great Influenza, it killed more people in 24 weeks than AIDS has killed in 24 years. More people in a year than the Black Death of the Middle Ages killed in a century. There were many echoes of the Middle Ages in 1918. Victims turned blue-black, and priests in some of the world's most modern cities drove horse-drawn carts down the streets, calling upon people to bring out their dead. But this wasn't the Middle Ages. It was 1918. This new strain of influenza, an H1N1 virus, struck like a thief in the night. Victims would recall walking down the street and being hit by waves of giddiness, muscles turning to water, a crushing headache. Or they'd go to bed feeling fine and wake up a few hours later, horribly ill. One story from 1918 tells of four women playing bridge together late into the night, By dawn the next day, 3 were dead from flu. People in poor countries or living in crowded conditions suffered the most. But the pandemic didn't restrict itself to the servants' entrance. Famous people who caught it but survived include Kafka, UK Prime Minister David Lloyd George, Walt Disney, then a teenager in the Red Cross Ambulance Corps, Spain's King Alfonso XIII, silent screen star Mary Pickford, Ethiopia's Haile Selassie, and even US President Woodrow Wilson, who fell so ill during the signing of the Treaty of Versailles that his own doctor suspected he'd been poisoned. It killed the rich. It killed the creative. One of the early fatalities in the pandemic was Donald Trump's German-born grandfather, Friedrich, who died aged 49 in New York in May 1918. He felt ill while out walking one day and was dead the next. The French surrealist poet Apollinaire survived a shrapnel wound to the temple, only to die 2 years later, aged 38, from the flu. It also killed legions of soldiers. More than half the US troops who died in Europe were felled by influenza, not enemy fire. Most influenza epidemics hit hardest among the very young and the very old. Not this one. To everyone's surprise, the really soaring death rates were among healthy men in their prime, aged 20 to 40, and pregnant women. Of those mothers-to-be who survived, more than a quarter lost the baby. Why so many of the young and fit? One theory is that the young adults of that particular time lacked the right kind of immunity. Exposure to an influenza virus when you're young can increase resistance to a subsequent infection with the same or similar virus. While that generation were exposed to one kind of flu virus in their childhood, the 1889 pandemic, they were helpless against this new and different one. And their own healthy but frantic immune systems may have killed them. When the immune system goes into overdrive, it can produce what's known as a cytokine storm and ravage the body. That age spike is a phenomenon scientists are still trying to explain, because the answer could help predict who is at greatest risk in future pandemics. Could when you were born be a predictor of your immunity profile? And where did the virus originate? Not Spain. It's still hotly debated, but prime suspects include China, France, and even rural Kansas in the United States. It's likely it sprang from livestock and found a way to spread from human to human. It arrived in waves, the first infecting many but killing few, the second lethal. In an age without antibiotics, it was the secondary infections, such as bacterial pneumonia, that caused most of the deaths. By the time it had run its swift course, with a few final echoes in 1920, the pandemic had stalked the globe. Asians were 30 times more likely to die than Europeans. It reached even far-flung places like Western Samoa, as it was then, and Alaska, where it devastated locals. Heartbreaking photos show ragged bands of little Inuit orphans huddled together, stunned to have had 2 healthy parents one day and none the next. Indeed, the world of 1918 was left full of orphans. A virus doesn't have a heart. Why should we care about a pandemic, however catastrophic, that happened a century ago? Because it will happen again, even with all our medical advances. It's why scientists are still raking over clues from the 1918 outbreak. They want to crack the unpredictable workings of that great survivor, the influenza virus. As far as anyone knows, the single task of a virus is to reproduce, yet it can't do that by itself. it has to invade and take control of a living cell. The raided cell then begins producing not what it needs, but what the viral genes demand. Hundreds of thousands of viral proteins to form new viruses. A mass of them then bursts through the cell surface, usually killing the cell in the process, to swarm through the body, invading other cells. It doesn't pay to sell a virus short. As John Barry writes, even if viruses perform only one task, they are not simple, nor are they primitive. Highly evolved, elegant in their focus, more efficient at what they do than any fully living being, they have become nearly perfect infectious organisms. And the influenza virus is among the most perfect of these perfect organisms. Influenza viruses, there are a number, can be found somewhere in the world at any time. In temperate climates, influenza appears every year as seasonal flu, typically in autumn and winter, in familiar strains. As we know, seasonal flu can cause serious illness and death. However, it's not usually fatal or extreme in most people. Pandemic flu is a whole other story. It occurs when a flu virus that is new to humans, or at least very different from seasonal flu viruses, appears, one that most of the population has never encountered. The 20th century saw three serious influenza pandemics. 1918, the Asian flu in 1957, and the Hong Kong flu in 1968. The last two combined killing a few million people. This century, the 2009 pandemic, known as swine flu, sprang up in Mexico and the US and swept the world. It wasn't as bad as feared, but still killed many thousands. So does seasonal influenza, which kills roughly between 300,000 and 650,000 people globally each year. In industrialised countries, however, most of the deaths are among those aged over 65. Which isn't to say we don't worry about seasonal influenza, especially as it's now known to greatly raise the risk of life-threatening conditions such as heart attacks. One recent Canadian study found that people, especially older people, were 6 times more likely to have a heart attack in the week after being diagnosed with influenza, compared to 12 months before or after the infection. Drops in oxygen levels and shifts in blood pressure as the inflamed body battles the flu could increase the risk of clots. Flu's potential to affect other organs, from heart to brain, played out in a tragic case last year. In August, Kerry Alexander, a 13-year-old Sydney schoolboy, was taken to hospital suffering severe flu symptoms. The teenager was so ill he couldn't walk, yet he was discharged in the early hours of the morning, despite his parents' concern. 12 hours later, Kerry was dead. Cause of death was found to be borderline myocarditis, an inflammation of the heart muscle, most likely brought on by the influenza A virus. It had led to cardiac arrest. In much of Australia, 2017's seasonal flu was the most widespread in a decade, with 2.5 times as many reported cases as in 2016. The season also ran longer than usual, giving plenty of opportunity to catch the bug. Both the old and the young were hospitalised. We definitely saw more children in hospital with flu. Some had the usual things, breathing difficulties, fever, in need of intravenous support, but some had neurological complications, things like seizures and encephalitis. We do see these during flu seasons, but anecdotally at least, we saw a lot last year. Says Dr. Brendan McMullen, a paediatric infectious diseases specialist at Sydney Children's Hospital. Most people haven't been vaccinated against flu, so it's no surprise when they come down with it. What baffled many of those laid up in bed, aching and feverish, was why they had caught it, and badly, even when they'd had a flu shot. A flu vaccine is far from perfect, that's why. A new one has to be devised each year, and while it's not quite a stab in the dark, it's part educated guesswork, part gamble. The elusive holy grail for researchers is a once-only, one-size-fits-all flu vaccine that gives 100% protection. If only influenza viruses weren't quite so mercurial, so variable, the quest would be a whole lot easier. Meanwhile, the vaccine experts advising the World Health Organization have to settle for covering as many bases as they can, says Professor Kanta Subbarao, director of the WHO Collaborating Centre for Reference and Research on Influenza in Melbourne. There are four strains of influenza that cause epidemics, Subbarao explains. Two influenza A viruses, H1N1, H3N2, and two influenza B viruses, two lineages. In any given season, we don't know which of these four will dominate, or whether more than one will circulate, so we include all four components in the vaccine. So far, so good. The guesswork, the gamble, lies in deciding which particular strains representing each of the four to include, 4 to 6 months ahead of the flu season, because that's how long it takes to make the vaccine. Not surprisingly, a lot can go wrong. For example, the experts could pick the wrong one, and the vaccine virus doesn't match the real virus that ends up circulating. That's called a mismatch. But Subbarao doesn't believe that's what happened in 2017. She says the problem was that the vaccine virus underwent changes during the process of making it. 95% of the world's vaccine is manufactured in chicken's eggs. Unfortunately, when we take influenza viruses from somebody's throat and put them into eggs to make a vaccine, there are a few small changes that the virus picks up along the way in order to grow well in eggs. So the vaccine virus could be out of whack with some of the viruses actually going around and won't induce protective immunity. For that matter, the vaccine against H3N2 hasn't been very effective for the past 5 years or so, Subbarao acknowledges. And that's unfortunate because H3N2 is one of the bad sorts, affecting the whole population. It causes more severe disease, more secondary complications, and can be more of a killer for old and young. It was H3N2 that dominated in 2017, here and in the US especially, although influenza B was also around. So why bother with a flu shot? Experts insist it's better than nothing, provides at least partial protection, and can be effective against H1N1 and B viruses. It also lowers the risk of passing flu on to vulnerable groups, such as the elderly or chronically ill. The downside? It doesn't help everyone. You can get it too early or too late for it to be of much use. Late April to mid-May is now recommended. And it may not work as well in people over 65. It's far from the magic bullet that medical science would like, as virologists such as Associate Professor Ian Mackay of the University of Queensland admit. It's certainly not as effective as other childhood vaccines, like for mumps, measles, and so on, Mackay says. The flu vaccine's effectiveness can be as low as 20 to 30%. Some years it's been recorded as even less than that. A good year is about 60% effectiveness. Mackay gives a deep sigh when Good Weekend asks why people so often say, "I had the flu shot and then I got the flu." In other words, they're convinced they got the flu as a result of the vaccination. "This really makes me annoyed," Mackay says. "I don't know why anybody still believes that in this day and age. There is no infectious active influenza virus in these vaccines, so it's impossible, literally impossible, to get the flu from the vaccine. Now, what is not impossible is that at the same time as you got vaccinated, somebody next to you sneezed and you picked up the actual flu then, before the vaccine had its 2-week period to get you some immunisation. There are also multiples of flu virus circulating, so you've got usually a couple of influenza Bs and a couple of influenza As and lots of variants within that. So if the vaccine is only maybe 20 or 30% effective, it will protect you against some things and not others. He also dismisses the notion that it's because people are getting vaccinated that more virulent strains of influenza are springing up. In other words, that having a partially protected population is forcing different, more potent flu variants to emerge, to dodge the immunity and spread. There are a couple of arguments against that, Mackay says. One is that we don't have any evidence for it. The second is that very few people in Australia in some groups get vaccinated. So very few children, for example, are getting vaccinated, which means people who are massive transmitters of flu virus aren't getting a lot of vaccine. So that's not what's driving it. There's a lot of variation happening in the virus normally. For that matter, most of the new and exotic influenza strains start out in parts of the world where vaccination rates are low, such as Mexico or Southeast Asia. New strains are more likely to arise from poor animal husbandry practices, where the virus can jump species. Live animal markets, or wet markets, in Asia, are a particular worry to authorities. For the record, it's a two-way street. Humans often infect animals, especially pigs, with human flu. Aside from the hit-and-miss nature of the vaccines themselves, one of the unknowns is just how long immunity lasts, whether it's the kind induced by vaccine or by natural infection. John Matthews, an epidemiologist and professorial fellow in the School of Population Health at the University of Melbourne, explains. We do know immunity tends to wane over time, even the natural immunity, and it probably wanes even more quickly for vaccine immunity. If you give a healthy young person vaccine, then the protective immunity might last 6 months, or even into the next season, and natural immunity tends to last longer. Neither of those will last as long if you're elderly. Why? Because just as older people start losing their ordinary memory, their body's immune memory also fades. It forgets how to fight off infections it might have encountered previously. It's the reason two new and stronger dose vaccines for older people have now been approved by the federal government for use here. And in response to the number of seriously ill children hospitalised with flu in 2017, New South Wales and Victoria are now offering free influenza shots to all children aged 6 months to under 5 years. As for 2018's upcoming seasonal flu, what can we expect? There is no way of knowing if we're in for a bad year, says Sue Burrell. If we've had a very bad season before, we hope that means everyone will have some natural immunity to that particular virus, so one of the others might have a chance at causing the epidemic. And H1N1 and influenza B epidemics are not as severe as H3N2. H3N2 sweeps through a community. Are we likely to see it happening again 2 years in a row? Usually we say no, but the United States has just had that happen 2 years in a row. So really, nobody knows. More importantly, when are we due for another pandemic? For the past 300 years, the average has been 3 per century, but viruses don't follow a timetable. A spillover event, where a virus finds a way to survive in a new host, could happen at any time, with terrible consequences. Ebola was a spillover event, from bats to humans. The flu is a very clever pathogen because it's able to juggle its genes, says Matthews. So if you happen to be infected by two different strains of flu virus and they get into the same cell, they can recombine their genes and produce something that's quite novel. That ability, known as reassortment, to create an entirely new, or even just relatively new, hybrid virus, might explain why the 1918 virus was so devastating. It also explains why influenza is such a survivor. It's constantly getting a makeover. Although its major impact in the hemispheres is seasonal, in the tropics it busily ticks over all year round, with plenty of time to shapeshift and bypass immunity we might have built up. That's the basic reason flu hasn't gone away. It's too mutable, Matthews says. It's why other vaccines provide more permanent protection. For example, the virus that causes smallpox can't change in ways to escape immunity induced by previous smallpox infection or vaccination. Still, it's not as if world health authorities are asleep at the wheel. In recent years, for example, the WHO has been keeping a close eye on H7N9, an avian flu virus in China. For now, it's only being transmitted from bird to human, not human to human. And, says Ian Mackay, a poultry vaccination program seems to have reduced the likelihood of a spillover. That's also good news for animals. In past years, mass slaughters have quietly been carried out on infected livestock as a preemptive measure. In 2003, for example, the WHO identified a new virus in European poultry farms. It infected 83 people and killed one, a vet. Public health authorities in the Netherlands, Belgium, and Germany slaughtered nearly 30 million animals, mostly poultry, but some swine. We do know another pandemic will happen. We just don't have a date. There was one famous influenza virologist who said, well, we had a pandemic in 1957, the next one in 68, then there was a novel virus that emerged in 77. So he wrote these papers saying it would happen every 10 or 11 years. Everybody waited the 11 years, and nothing happened. It's notoriously difficult to predict what happens with flu. What most people will say comfortably is that we will have a pandemic in the future. When the right combination of events come together, a virus that has acquired the properties to be able to infect and spread in people, and a population that is not immune, you'll have a pandemic.
The newsrooms of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald are all working remotely during the coronavirus pandemic, so this episode has been recorded from our homes and the sound quality isn't the best. But rest assured, we'll be back in the studio as soon as we can.
Hello, my name's Katrina Strickland and I'm the editor of Good Weekend magazine. Here to join me today for a discussion about the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic are Fenella Souter, freelance writer and former editor of Good Weekend from 1997 to 2004, and Professor Kanta Subbarao, a virologist and physician with the Doherty Institute, who's director of the WHO Collaborating Centre for Reference and Research on Influenza. Welcome, Fenella and Kanta.
Thank you.
Hi, Katrina.
So, Kanta, there's been a lot of talk about this starting in the wet markets of Wuhan. How similar or not is that to how the Spanish flu started?
So that's a great question. We know much less about where the 1918 virus, how it emerged, where it emerged. It got the name Spanish flu because Spain was neutral during World War I, and they announced that they had people dying of this illness, whereas other countries that clearly had disease did not report it because of the war. So the name Spanish flu, attributing it to Spain, is really not accurate. the naming of these viruses, I mean, people are taking great pains not to name the place because of the stigma. We do know that it is likely to have come from an animal.
And does that mean from eating an animal or just being around?
From being around. So influenza viruses, the biology is different from coronaviruses in that influenza viruses have a genome that's organized in segments, sort of like chromosomes. So if you have a person that is infected with an influenza virus, human influenza virus, for instance, and infected with a bird virus or a virus from pigs, and the person is infected at exactly the same time, the viruses can actually exchange genetic material, and what can come out would be a completely new virus. Now, if you look at coronaviruses, the SARS virus was tracked down to live markets in southern China, where there were a number of animals that wild-caught animals that were prepared in restaurants for eating, and those animals were infected with SARS. However, many of them actually came from farms, and none of the farmed animals had them. So the source, the intermediate host, is believed to have been a civet cat, but if you track it back to the origin, it came from bats. This virus, we assume because of epidemiologic links that there is a link to wet markets in Wuhan, but there's also some analysis that says that not everybody in that first few cases that came to attention in Wuhan, not all of them had contact with the live market. So it's a little unclear, and we may never know exactly which animal in the live markets was the intermediate host.
And did you and your colleagues see this coming in a way that the rest of us didn't? Did you have earlier signs than anyone else?
So that would be a yes and no answer. So we've all been worried about another pandemic, but of course we've been talking about an influenza pandemic, not a coronavirus pandemic. Did we think that a coronavirus pandemic could occur? We certainly thought a new coronavirus could emerge. We've had three in the last 20 years. SARS in 2002, 2003, MERS that appeared in 2012 and is still with us. And we knew that both of those viruses had tracked back to bats. Did we think it would take off like this? I think this virus is different from SARS and MERS. And the game changer is the ability of this virus to spread from person to person very efficiently.
And that's just a clever adaptation the way viruses do, right?
Right. And so in the end, this is behaving like an influenza virus rather than a coronavirus, but it is a coronavirus. So it brings some of the characteristics of a coronavirus and it's overlaid onto the way an influenza virus would spread.
And just remind us briefly, what is the difference between an influenza and a coronavirus?
They belong to different families of viruses. So viruses are classified based on the nature of their nucleic acid into DNA-containing viruses and RNA genomes. So coronaviruses and influenza viruses, the whole families of these viruses, are both RNA viruses. So their genome is as RNA. The coronavirus genome is almost twice as big as the influenza genome.
Right. And Fenella, we can call you Nostradamus, as we've been joking, because you were alert to this. I think the cover story that you did in April 2018, what made you want to do that story? And just to remind everyone, it was really on the 100-year anniversary of the Spanish flu and what we could learn from it.
Well, I was interested that we seem to have largely forgotten this sort of enormous event, historical event, that actually killed more people than the First World War, which is much more remembered. So, you know, I was interested in looking at the history of that and the impact that it had. And then, of course, when I started to speak to people like Kanta, you know, I thought, well, this could happen anytime because it doesn't happen all the time, the jump from an animal to a human, but it's obviously possible something would happen at some time. And, you know, as Carter pointed out in my article, there was a theory that these things happen, I think it was every 11 years, but then, of course, it didn't happen every 11 years. So in other words, they're quite random and we don't really know, but we do know with global travel, with the fact that we've all got so much contact with each other, that if something like this does arise, it's very likely to be spread quite widely, especially if it's something like this particularly efficient coronavirus.
And what are the similarities in how it was handled back then to now. I remember in the story we had a picture of troops with face masks, which at the time that we ran it seemed so far-fetched, but of course now doesn't seem that strange at all.
Now it's sort of up the supermarket, isn't it? Yeah, I know. Well, masks were compulsory for quite a time in the, I mean, Australia really got it in January 1919. The rest of the world had had it in 1918. And, of course, troop ships coming back were a great carrier for it. And many of those, it's interesting that there was a maritime quarantine because, of course, there wasn't air travel then. So a lot of troop ships were quarantined in Sydney Harbour, much to the horror of the residents of Rose Bay and so on, who didn't really want them nearby or didn't want the quarantine station at Manly either, for that matter. So those, for a while, they thought that that maritime quarantine might keep things under control, and it did. But then, unfortunately, well, we have to blame Victoria here. I don't know whether it's true, but this is the story, that Victoria allowed some soldiers to come on land, and perhaps it was spread there, and then they caught a train to New South Wales, and then it took off. But the face masks, the closing of schools, dance halls, churches, you know, department stores, I think. Well, actually, department stores had, some of them had, I think it was one of them had a things called inhalatoriums where you could go and have sulfate of zinc fumes for their customers, you know, could go and inhale these, which were supposed to be efficacious in some way. But I think it was interesting, the differences. Like, there was a terrible scandal for Catholics anyway when a young nurse at the quarantine station died from influenza very early on, and they wouldn't let a priest come in and administer the last rites, and this sort of caused a huge furor between Catholics and Protestants and the authorities and the Catholic Church. So it's interesting what the concerns were then, and you know, we see sort of our own versions of people being outraged at not being allowed to do things or the restrictions that are placed on. But I think the other great lesson, and maybe Cantor will speak to this as well, is that you can't relax too early. You know, they did start loosening the restrictions, I think, in about August in 1919. It came back again, you know, so that's always a very difficult decision.
Cantor, tell us about that. The second wave is often more lethal than the first. Is that something we should worry about here?
So that, you know, a lot of these extrapolations are made from influenza. So sort of bearing that in mind, the first time the virus sweeps through the population, that's called the first wave. And then very often months later, there's a second wave. And the second wave affects anyone that was spared in the first wave. And so the argument really is that if you have put in place social distancing measures as we have, that a large proportion of the population will actually have been protected the first go around and will be susceptible the second time around. With influenza, our big hope is to have developed a vaccine or have antiviral drugs available in time for the second wave, because it's very, very difficult to say that you'll have something in place vaccine, you know, wise, for the first wave. So the expectation is that if we can change anything, we'll primarily be changing the outcome of the second wave. So I don't know that the virus would become more virulent. There's always a possibility that the virus will mutate. So you understand that these viruses go from an animal into a human, and then they spread from person to person. So almost all these viruses will acquire some mutations, some genetic properties that enhance their properties of, you know, spread. And some of those changes could actually make the disease less severe, or they could make the disease more severe. And so that is some of what's happening right now in real time, is that people are monitoring the changes in the virus. So I wouldn't say that we necessarily know that the second wave will be worse in terms of severity of disease, but it could have almost as large an impact on the population, depending on, you know, sort of how it comes through. But our hope would be that we're better prepared. A, we know what social distancing measures work. B, we might have antiviral drugs available. C, we might have vaccines available. And D, we spare the hospitals the big sudden surge.
It's interesting, isn't it, how much travel has really turbocharged it this time around. Fenella, tell us about the troop ship that went to Western Samoa.
Well, it left New Zealand, and New Zealand is a case in point that they had a massive amount of cases very early on. I think it was 6,000 cases in 12 weeks or something. But anyway, so it was known to be there. This ship left Auckland. I think it was quarantined briefly in Fiji, but then it sailed on to Western Samoa, as it was at the time. And they knew infection was on board. And, you know, I don't want to mention the Ruby Princess, but it does ring certain bells about this. And they let infected passengers off, with the result that within a matter of weeks, I think it was something like 6-8 weeks, 22% of the local population of Western Samoa were dead. So, you know, that was a case where you just think, well, why did that happen? You know, why wasn't that ship stopped? Why were those passengers let off? So, yes, it does sort of resonate now, I think.
But I guess the lesson from Fenella's story is that we knew that really ships carry it, and that maritime people need to be super vigilant in making sure that if it's on the ship, it doesn't get off the ship. But we obviously didn't learn that lesson. We forgot about it.
Well, I think in fairness, I think over the years with flu and norovirus, the cruise companies are much more aware of infectious disease outbreaks. I think with COVID-19, there was a lot we were learning. And certainly the first one that was in the news in Japan was the first time anyone, you know, experienced something on that scale.
Speaking of scale, I mean, when I looked at, you know, you look at the figures of the 1918 influenza pandemic, and it is massive. And of course, the world was a much smaller place then, 50 million people, you know, or at least 20 to 30 at a conservative estimate. Now, we're not seeing, that was over a year. We're not seeing figures anywhere like that at the moment. Is it going to get to that point, or is that pandemic way worse than what we're seeing now?
I think it is. You know, if you look at the actual numbers, it is much worse in terms of mortality than this one is, because, you know, remember that 80% of cases of COVID-19 recover. And it's really only 20% that go to the hospital. And there's a very remarkable increase in risk of severe disease and death as you go up in age. Whereas in 1918, 1919, a lot of the illness, severe illness and death was in young adults. So I think there are a couple of things that are different in terms of the demographics and how this is played out. Whereas in the COVID-19 outbreak, the young, otherwise healthy people have, by and large, have milder disease. Whereas people that are older than age 60 and people that have underlying health conditions are at much greater risk of severe disease and death.
So, you know, do you think we're likely to come with a vaccine? When I say we, I mean you and your colleagues.
Well, I mean, it's a very exciting time in terms of vaccine development, because, of course, we've had vaccines made the traditional way, which is to grow a virus and inactivate its infectivity, concentrate it and inject it into people. That's the traditional way. And certainly that's one way to make vaccines even today. But there's also been a huge amount of progress in the types of technology that are available. So the vaccines that are being evaluated right now that are the first off the block are these very new methods. And so it is a very exciting space to watch.
And Kanta, do you think it's more likely that we'll find a solution in a vaccine or in a treatment for people who have caught COVID-19?
I really think we need a combination of the two. A vaccine works to prevent infection. And so we need a vaccine. And there are many steps to get a vaccine into people. So I was saying earlier that we've got all this exciting technology. The first clinical trials are starting. But we do not have a licensed coronavirus vaccine for use in humans. So we have no experience with doing such a thing. And so there will have to be a very close watch on safety, on the immune response from the vaccine, and on whether it works. So I think the reality is that the soonest we will have a vaccine for use in people is 12 to 18 months away. So in the interim, and in addition to vaccines, antiviral drugs and non-pharmaceutical interventions like social distancing have very important roles to play. So I think right now the fastest way to have an antiviral treatment is to use drugs that are already in existence, that are licensed for other uses, that show activity against coronavirus in the test tube, and then to test them in people.
And how soon do you think that is?
So there are a lot of clinical trials going on right now. I think there were over 300 clinical trials listed right now, mainly trying existing drugs that we call repurposing. So they're drugs that are licensed for use for other reasons that have some reason, either theoretical or at least in a test tube, evidence of activity against COVID-19 that are now being evaluated. And I think everybody should understand why it's so important to evaluate them carefully, because not everything that works in a test tube will work in people.
If you had been in charge before this happened, what would you have put in place differently to how the world operates now to try and minimize the chance of a pandemic?
I don't think that's ever going to happen. Nobody's going to make me in charge. But but I would say that I think ignoring the science and not supporting the kinds of research that would have prepared us better for these instances or these events is a mistake. We've had two warnings. And yet, we're sort of, as a society, decisions about vaccine development and drug development are very much driven by the size of the market. And so with SARS, we made a lot of progress with vaccine development. But because SARS went away, none of those vaccines were taken to market. They weren't taken through development.
We took the foot off the pedal, really, didn't we? Yeah,
exactly. And it's because because of the method by which vaccine development is done in the world. So in fact, if it really needs a public-private partnership so that there is public money invested in these things that may or may not make money for industry, but we really need these. So it's a difficult one because the public doesn't have that much of an appetite for us investing huge sums of money to develop a vaccine against something that came and went. So it really takes the ability to step back and say, no, this could happen again. We need to be better prepared.
So even if it didn't help today's, the research and the kind of following it through would help us develop today's, because we would have so much more knowledge.
Absolutely, because what we are able to do with influenza today is base a lot of our assumptions on influenza vaccines that we are very comfortable with. So if we even had that much information about how to safely make a coronavirus vaccine, or had we carried on drug development so that we had pan-coronavirus drugs, we would be in a better place.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please remember to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And remember to rate and comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Good Weekend Talks is brought to you by the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our writers. To support independent journalism, search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. This episode was produced and edited by Anu Hasbold, with editorial assistance from Conrad Marshall and technical assistance from Cormac Lally. Tom McKendrick is head of audio, and Katrina Strickland is the editor of Good Weekend. I'm Conrad Marshall. Thanks for listening.